Okay, so so first set a good motivation, and we'll do our vows.
Okay, we'll start with our prayers. So let's sit a moment and really think of the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas and other enlightened beings before us. Think of your spiritual mentors and those that have really inspired you in your path, that have really turned your mind towards spiritual practice. And develop a sense of openness and receptivity to them. I take refuge in my gurus. I take refuge in the Buddha. I take refuge in the Dhamma. I take refuge in the Sangha. I take refuge in my gurus. I take refuge in the Buddha. I take refuge in the Dhamma. I take refuge in the Sangha. I take refuge in my gurus. I take refuge in the Buddha. I take refuge in the Dhamma. I take refuge in the Sangha. From the heart of the Lord of the Gandhan Devas emerges a brilliant white cloud like a great mass of fresh yogurt. Atop sits Tsongkhapa, all-knowing king of Dhamma. We request your coming to this place along with your great disciples. My Lord Guru is seated before me on a lion throne, lotus, and wind cushion. His white face smiles blissfully. Please remain many eons and serve as the supreme merit field for the growth of my mind of faith and for the increase of Lord Buddha's teachings. Your omniscient wisdom mind encompasses all that is existent. Your speech is a profound teaching which ornaments the ear of the fortunate. Your body's beautiful radiance evokes wondrous admiration. I prostrate to you, Lama Tsongkhapa, who merely viewing, hearing, contemplating earns one great merit. I present to you, supreme field of merit, Tsongkhapa, delightful offerings, pure sweet water, various flowers, fragrant incense, butter lamps, perfumes, and more, both physical and mental offerings, vast as the clouds and wide as the ocean. The unwholesome actions of body, speech, and mind have accumulated since time without beginning, especially actions contrary to my three vows, Vinaya, Bodhisattva, Vajrayana, I regret extremely from the depths of my heart and reveal each and every such. And here we're going to stop on in the rejoicing part. So let's read this verse first and then contemplate rejoicing. Rejoicing is the energy of really appreciating all the excellent things in your life, your precious human life, and all those that have really brought wisdom and insight into your life around you. So really have a sense of rejoicing. Rejoicing also is this powerful, as we're saying, the seven limbs. This particular limb gives you natural energy. When you think of the energy needed for practice, for joy and propulsion in your practice, it is really the aspect of rejoicing and cultivating joy in your life. So so we'll say this verse and then really think about those that have benefited you in your life, and also think of the things that you have done to benefit others, and in this way rejoice in them. Because sometimes we diminish and forget to acknowledge all the good things that we've done for others. And so, you know, remembering and thinking about how you have helped others also gives you a lot of energy for your practice. Yeah, energy for the long way to enlightenment, or short way, depending on where you are. Okay, so we'll read this and then contemplate it for a bit. We totally rejoice in your magnificent achievements, my Lord. You strove for knowledge and realization, abandoned the eight worldly concerns, and made the most meaningful use of human life with the 18 opportune conditions during these degenerate times. So first contemplate the excellences of our spiritual mentors and enlightened beings everywhere, and of your spiritual friends. And then take time to rejoice in your own virtuous activities. And we'll continue on. Pray all you holy gurus, unerring in conduct, precipitate a rain of vast and profound dharma from the billowing clouds of wisdom and compassion which fill the Dharmakaya sky, providing for the field of disciples precisely what is needed. May the Vajra body, created from the purity of clear light, free of the rising and setting of cyclic existence, but visible to the ordinary viewer only in its unsubtle physical form, stay on unchanging, without waning, until samsara ends. May whatever virtue I have gathered here beneficially serve all sentient beings and the Buddha Dharma, and especially may the gentle teachings of the unerring master, Tsongkhapa, shine forever. Jai Tsongkhapa, crown jewel of the holy masters of the land of snows, you are Avalokiteshvara, great treasure of inconceivable compassion, untainted by ego's delusion. You are Manjushri, powerful master with stainless wisdom. You are Vajrapani, destroyer of forces of demons. At your feet, famed Lozang Gata, I humbly bow and earnestly request that all sentient beings achieve enlightenment. Jai Tsongkhapa, crown jewel of the holy masters of the land of snows. You are Avalokiteshvara, great treasure of inconceivable compassion, untainted by ego's delusion. You are Manjushri, powerful master with stainless wisdom. You are Vajrapani, destroyer of the forces of demons. At your feet, famed Lozang Drakpa, I humbly bow and earnestly request that all sentient beings achieve enlightenment. Jai Tsongkhapa, crown jewel of the holy masters of the land of snows. You are Avalokiteshvara, great treasure of inconceivable compassion, untainted by ego's delusion. You are Manjushri, powerful master with stainless wisdom. You are Vajrapani, destroyer of forces of demons. At your feet, famed Lozang Drakpa, I humbly bow and earnestly request that all sentient beings attain enlightenment. I just wanted to share for people who are new, Lama Tsongkhapa is the head of the started the tradition of the Gelugpa order in Tibet, and this is a statue of Lama Tsongkhapa, the center one, with his two main disciples on either side. He lived in the 14th century, and he was an incredible practitioner, scholar, author, teacher. He was, when you go through his writings or hear about his teachings, even the Dalai Lama speaks about him a lot, you know, referring to his teachings, because he was someone who clarified so many obscure points in the texts about emptiness and other aspects. So, not only was he a brilliant scholar and author, but he was a practitioner as well. And there's so many stories about him living in caves with a few disciples, I think eight disciples, for years in practice, meditating and doing some of the purification practices. And Geshe-la says, you know, this was because he was already enlightened, but it was to show us what we need to do. Not that we have to all go to caves, but really looking at the necessity of practice, that we should not take the teachings as just something intellectual that we just sit in and or read a book and become an armchair Buddhist, you know, but something that we really apply and work on in our lives to diminish our gross and subtle delusions about the nature of ourselves and phenomena in our world. So he was an amazing being, and actually, when His Holiness the Dalai Lama teaches in San Francisco this month, April, he'll be giving a commentary on one of Lama Tsongkhapa's texts, which is really, really a gem, because not only is it brilliant, it's very expansive and brings a lot of joy to one's heart. Because it's called the harmony of emptiness and dependent arising, and it really helps bridge our understanding about conventional reality of causes and conditions, but also the true nature of conditioned existence. So it's really quite exquisite. And so when we recite this three times, it's recognizing Lama Tsongkhapa, and it's sharing how he has these aspects of three enlightened beings. So the first one is Avalokiteshvara, which is a Sanskrit word for the Tibetan name Chenrezi, or the Buddha of compassion. So it's talking about the qualities of compassion. And the next one is Manjushri, the qualities of wisdom. And Vajrapani, really the qualities of power and the ability to overcome delusions and negativities and obstacles in life. So it's really going over the qualities of Tsongkhapa. So the next part here, again, it's thinking about calling your spiritual mentor, your teacher or the Buddha, an enlightened being, first to the crown of your head. And then the second one is imagining that they dissolve into light, descend through the crown of your head, and just flood your own body and mind with with light and wisdom and compassion. And then imagine that your teacher, your spiritual mentor, an enlightened being now, not somebody who's a sidewalk, what would you say? A sidewalk mentor or whatever, right? But someone who's really tread the path and attained enlightenment, excuse me. And then think of them sitting at your heart, non-different from your pure potential. Okay, so we'll recite those three verses. Glorious and precious root guru, please take the lotus feet at my crown, and in your kindness, please care for us. Bestow on us the attainments of your body, speech, and mind. Glorious, precious root guru, please take the lotus seat at our hearts, and in your great kindness, care for us. Grant us your blessings for our temporal success and for the supreme attainment. Glorious, precious root guru, please take the lotus seat at our hearts, and in your great kindness, remain with us. Remain steadfast until we achieve the essence of enlightenment. So sit with that meditation for a moment. Call to mind your spiritual mentor. Imagine their energy, their wisdom and love for you, embodied in a very pure form of light and energy, comes to the crown of your head. And dissolves into light, floods your body, speech, and mind with this pure, blissful, creative, enlightened energy. And then manifests again at your heart, very tiny, none different than your enlightened potential. And we'll continue. And call to mind your understanding of the nature of emptiness or interdependence. Unthinkable, inexpressible, wisdom gone beyond, unborn, unceasing, space-like in essence, clearly perceived by wisdom mind, homage to the mother of the Buddhas of the three times. Gone, gone, gone beyond, gone completely beyond, so be it. Gone, gone, gone beyond, gone completely beyond, so be it. Gone, gone, gone beyond, gone completely beyond, so be it. So we'll sit in meditation for a few moments. And we'll recite the mandala offering, make it as beautiful in your mind as you can, sharing this with Buddhas and Bodhisattvas, enlightened beings, and all beings everywhere. By the virtue of offering to you, assembly of Buddhas, visualized before me, this mandala built on a base resplendent with flowers, saffron, water, and incense, adorned with Mount Meru and the four continents, as well as with the sun and moon, may all sentient beings share its effects. Iram Guru Ratna Mandala Kamniyatayami. I go for refuge until I am enlightened to the Buddhas, the Dhamma, and the highest assembly from the virtuous merit of teaching the teachings. May I attain Buddhahood for the benefit of all sentient beings. I go for refuge until I'm enlightened to the Buddhas, the Dhamma, and the highest assembly from the virtuous merit of teaching the Dhamma. May I attain Buddhahood for the benefit of all sentient beings. I go for refuge until I'm enlightened to the Buddhas, the Dhamma, and the highest assembly from the virtuous merit of teaching the Dhamma. May I attain Buddhahood for the benefit of all sentient beings. Okay, where are we? Where are we? Four Noble Truths. We've come to which truth? Okay. What's the fourth noble truth?
There's a path.
Path to cessation, path to enlightenment, path to practice. The path. That's what's just so extraordinary. You know, when you think about some spiritual faiths, there's no path. There's no path. They just talk about things, but there's no path about how you can attain that, how you can get from where we are today to enlightenment. So there's a path, a way to go. So that's what Buddhism talks about, is the beauty of the path to get from the state of unenlightenment to the state of enlightenment. You know? So This is the part that is essential as you explore other paths, whether you're a Buddhist now or not. As you explore and analyze different philosophies and paths, it's important to see, is there a way to get from point A to point B? Now, to really find out if there's and where you are going, you need to analyze it, because some faiths can be very beautiful and flowery and great, but there's no path there. So it's important to check up and see what I'm studying, what its purpose is, where am I going, what am I doing with it. So for any of these things that you engage in, it's important to check and see what is the direction of this path. Okay? And so I was thinking about how the potential is, right, as we said in our prayers, so that I may attain enlightenment for the benefit of all beings, that we have that potential to attain enlightenment. That's pretty remarkable, pretty outstanding, and I think this is one of the things that draws us, because it's looking at our potential. It's looking at the possibility for us to stop being jerks, right? To stop being obnoxious and harming ourselves and others, and really cultivate excellent qualities so that we can be of the greatest benefit to others. And so there's this path. And you know, the first time I went to India, I think that's one of the things I think Bob and Doran can attest to, you know, of the meeting the teachers for the first time. It's like these Tibetans were really, really struggling, you know, incredible struggling in exile. I mean, imagine losing your country and having to go live in India of all places. You know? And it's much better today than it was in 1959, when so many of them escaped. Incredibly tragic situation. And so to think, you know, when we met these teachers, still with all their poverty, with all their loss, there was just so much joy joy and interest and strong cleaving to the path of practice, you know, that carried them. So here they were, destitute. I mean, you know, people walking in the snow with no socks on and struggling, living in tents or living in incredible challenged poverty, but just being so joyful and happy. Hi, welcome. So the path, we're looking at the potential and our own potential. So last week we looked at the cessation of suffering as the third aspect of the path, and I wanted to just finish up by going over this wheel of becoming. Someone else also last week, I don't know, asked what was the being holding up this wheel of life and showing it to us. Okay, so if you look in the back wall, there's like a monster holding up the wheel of life. And that is called Yama. It's the Lord of Death. He's the Lord of Death. And so very creative. He's just holding up a picture, a depiction of our conditioned existence and how we create suffering in our life again and again, endlessly. So Yama's holding that up and showing it to us and realizing, you know, that we cannot escape inevitable sickness, aging, and death in our lives. So just showing the condition of existence. But because we don't understand the nature of phenomena and things, because of our own self-cherishing and our own self-interest, then we engage and act upon projections that we misconstrue and misperceive. Right? We misunderstand how things exist because of our attachment, our aversion, and our erroneous perception of things. Okay? So, let me just show this part here first. So this was from Gen Gyatso, also looking at how we create suffering in our life. It's really stemming from negative karmic actions that we created in the past, negative actions of body, speech, and mind that created suffering in our life. And where did those negative karmic actions arise from? It came from our afflictive emotions of grasping, attachment, hatred, belligerence, jealousy, pride, all of these things, okay? And those in themselves arose from ignorance of understanding the nature of phenomena. So we create the causes for our own suffering. And in this chart, and I think most of you have this now, you can look at it, it's showing how we create. Klesha means delusions or negative actions, and karma create the conditions for an effect of our present existence. So in the past lifetime, then we created negative actions and karma in the past, which threw us into the present state we are in now, which is the effect. And through are engaging in things in this lifetime. Now we have this contact through our six senses and our consciousness, contact, feeling, and then because we crave things, then we create the conditions for further becoming. We're creating further karma and actions for a future lifetime. So one of the things that I just wanted to go on, based on your question last week, which triggered this sense of looking at the effects of suffering. So based on the Four Noble Truths, then, true sufferings, so the effects of the afflictive class of phenomena, what this is going to show now is both the afflictive nature of phenomena, and then also the pure class of phenomena. Okay, so for those of you who are just stepping in now, it might be a lot of stuff, but maybe it'll kind of meld together a little bit. Okay, so looking at the afflictive class of phenomena in reverse order, so the suffering of death that we will experience, is produced by having been born. Because we were born, we will have to experience death, isn't it? So then in the effects and looking in the reverse order, we were born because of the karma and klesha that we had created in the past. So it goes in reverse order, looking at the contaminated or afflictive class of phenomena. So looking at the causes, right, through causes, second noble truth, the cause of our suffering, it's because of the ignorance that produces further suffering. Ignorance produces our negative actions, right, which throws us into the particular kind of life and existence that we have now. So that's why the teachers say, if you want to know where you came from, look at your body and your circumstance and your life now. Right? And if you want to know where you're going for the future life, you look at your mind. You look at your mind because it's your mind that's really directing and determining the direction that you're going into. Okay? Because externally, you may look really pious and virtuous and helpful and beneficial to others, but what is the driving motivation under it? No? Is it driven by a need for attention and fame and this strong grasping neediness? No? To have a lot of attention poured onto you? Or what is the motivation behind? That's why they say, if you want to know where you're going, look at your mind. Because you look at your intention and actions of things. Okay, so then third noble truth, cessation. So it's looking at cessation as possible. We can get out of samsara. Okay, so then it says, looking at these 12 links in the way of purification. So when we, the cessation of death is dependent on the cessation of birth. If we weren't born, we won't have to experience death. Right? If we weren't born, we won't experience death. So, no, if we don't experience creating all this karma and klesha, then we won't experience the effect of another unenlightened birth and death. Okay? So now we're on true paths, causes of the pure class of phenomena. Again, it goes in the forward order. When ignorance ceases, the negative actions cease. When ignorance ceases, negative action ceases, which also sees the rebirth into an unenlightened existence. Okay. So it's looking at how you create more samsara and also the possibility of purifying samsara. Okay? Any questions? Yes?
Yeah, how do you determine what realm you're going to by your action, by your karma?
How do you determine what realm you're going into in your next life? Again, it's really important to look at your intentions and actions now and what you've created in this life. And, you know, some people are really terrified about what's going to happen later on. But, you know, I like how some of the teachers say we've been everything and we've done everything. Yeah. But what's important, what we can do and where our point of power is what we're doing in our life right now. Yeah. Really watching our actions of body, speech, and mind, our intention, and how we engage in others. Okay? So, all right. So when we look at these 12 links of becoming and how we engage in them, then we can see how the pattern of our reactive emotions have been in place for a long time, right? Negative actions and karma, the force of that creating the effect of the particular kind of life and tendencies, habitual tendencies that we get into in this particular lifetime. And you see that, you know, because of that habituation and tendency to do it again, then that we just drive the wheel home, right? We do it again, karma and klesha, creating the causes for the future lifetime. So where can we stop that? They say it's really by paying attention to our actions and in our present time, you know, really looking at how we are driven by afflictive emotions that propel us into negativities. So let me see. So here again, I just wanted to review. Actions are created from, negative actions are created from reactive emotions, right? Disturbing emotions that we reinterpreted as negative. And this came from the sensory stimulus and feeling tone, the emotional tone, which arises with every stimulus. Remember, I said sight sees shape and color. In hearing, you're only hearing loud, soft, rough, or natural sounds or sounds of speech and things, you know? So then, but what happens with every sensual stimulus stimulus that arises, there is the emotional tone of pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. Okay? Pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. So with each of those, there's something that's arising, and then we interpret it in a certain way and act upon it. So even though we're only seeing shape and color by our eyes, it's our mental consciousness that layers on all kinds of other stories upon it. Okay? And then out of, say, negativities, we grasp at it, we engage in negative actions. Okay, so we see how we continually commit them, and unless we cultivate attention and mindfulness of things, then we continue to do them and act out on them again and again. Okay, so looking at the characteristics of the First Noble Truth. First Noble Truth was? Truth of suffering. And so what are the characteristics of the First Noble Truth of suffering? What the characteristics does it have? Okay, it's the nature of suffering is one, which has three types of suffering. Suffering of change, and suffering of pervasive condition existence. Yeah? Okay, birth, aging, sickness, and death, right? So they're called the three marks of existence in the Theravada teachings, three marks of existence, or the four seals. So Mamie has named some of them with the suffering nature of existence. What's another characteristic of being in samsara?
Impermanence.
Everything changes. Yeah, right. We don't have that body like we had when we were 17 anymore, right? delusions. Well, delusions is part of the suffering.
Oh, attachment. Part of the suffering. Again.
Yeah. That's part of the suffering, yeah. The grasping attachment, yeah.
No inherent existence.
Okay, that is the fourth seal. But when you talk about the three marks of existence from the Theravada tradition, selflessness, no self. Okay, good, Reina. Yeah, so it's impermanence, the suffering nature of things, no inherent self-existence, and emptiness. So that's the difference between the three marks of existence and the four seals. Okay, lots of numbers in this study. But it's all trying to help clarify and look at the nature of mind and the nature of our consciousness and the nature of phenomena. Okay, so So in looking at that, then we have these wrong views that arise that we need to dispel. First one is thinking of our body as having a permanent aspect. Body and things around us having permanence. That there's something solid and strong that we're going to be around for a long time. Yeah, there is that. It's so funny because we have that feeling, but then we also know, you know, there's that tugging feeling like, I'm not going to be around here after a while. You know, you think about it, in another 100 years, there might be like a page and a photo of you somewhere.
Yeah.
And you know how we're so wrapped up in our life now, but 100 years from now, they'll say, oh, well, that was my great, great, great grand. Yeah. Uncle or something. You know? It's very interesting. Or they'll bring out your old high school yearbook, right? And we're a picture and a number in school somewhere. But in fact, you know, there's that 100 years from now, think of all that you've engaged in this lifetime and put so much effort into. What's it going to result in? Yeah. So thinking of this body as permanent and grasping at things as being static, we grasp at not only at our body and on our lives, but we grasp at others and at phenomena. My car, you know, the car, it's inevitable it's going to get dinged, you know, but look at the outrage we go through when our brand new car gets its first ding. Yeah? But it's a natural condition, you know, especially on the road or leaving it on the street, it's going to happen. Going to happen. Okay, so then another wrong view is thinking of our body as being a source of pleasure. Of course, there's pleasure in our body, but thinking of it as a source of pleasure, you know, and also seeing objects as pleasurable by nature. It's a misconception. No. I mean, there are meditations that people do where you can sit and analyze parts of your body. They do this zipper meditation where you imagine, you know, just a zipper taking off your skin and then looking at what's in there and analyzing it. And where is the pleasure and beauty and strong sensuous attachment to that? Oh, kidneys. You know, do you remember when Bernard Altshuler had to have a liver transplant? And I went to visit him before he got his liver, and he goes, liver, I don't even like liver. You know, and you look at how we just flip into this sense of our bodies being permanent, of being pleasurable and lasting. You know, all these qualities when it has, in fact, the nature of suffering and impermanence and no self. And it's empty. Okay? So thinking of the body as being clean and pure and grasping at our aggregates as pure. You know? And this one monk has stayed with us, you know, he says, yeah, I keep thinking my body's really great, you know, and then I have to go to the bathroom. So, you know, it's like having a more down-to-earth reality view, realistic view of our body and our aggregates and the things around us. You know, look at how when you're really attached to someone or you really in lust over someone. You know, it's like we have all these misconstrued views of how they are. When in fact, you know, it's completely opposite. So the fourth one is thinking of the body as composed of solid. So there's something solid and independent there, you know, thinking that there's a person that exists in an independent and self-supporting way. Okay, so So just for a moment, let's do a short meditation. Let's do a short meditation and looking at this. Before you close your eyes, this is what's classically known as the self. Form, feeling, perception, mental formations, and consciousness is what constitute you, or me. Anything missing here? Anything you'd like to add?
Ego.
Ego. That's all in the mental formations. So they're different. I'm sorry?
I think that covers it.
That covers it? Form is our body. Feeling, you know, we have attachment, pleasurable sensations, displeasurable sensations. Perception of perceiving things. Mental formations about them all. And then consciousness, apprehending things. This is the self. Okay? So now we'll do the meditation. Where is yourself? There seems to be something that you call I or me. Myself, where is it? Really look for it. If it's in your body, where is it in your body? If it's in your mind, which part of your mind is it in? Is it in the virtuous part of your mind? Or the happy part? What about the sad part? So where is this I that is so powerful that directs your life? Okay. Did anybody find it? Yeah.
For me, it's in my heart. It's where I visualize it being. In that the physical, spiritual.
In your heart. I just had a heart scan.
Then it's probably more a spiritual heart than a physical one. Are you talking about our physical bodies?
Are you?
No. that's just where I see it. That's where, if I think of finding it, that would be where.
Uh-huh. And where is the spiritual heart?
Well, because of some of the other training I've had, I visualize it being in my heart chakra.
Mm-hmm.
For lack of a better place to put it, that seems like a good place. Mm-hmm. So it would be here.
Uh-huh. When you think about the poor children in parts of Africa, where is your heart?
Usually the same place.
Okay. Uh-huh, Tina?
It's a reactor.
Just a reactor.
A process, something that's not static and that's moving. Did you find it, Christine? It's not unto itself. You realize when you start really trying to find this I, this self, that it becomes very elusive, very elusive. In my heart chakra. Have you seen your chakras?
Some of them. Just a visual, when meditating.
A visual. Yeah.
Colors.
Mm-hmm.
I can sit and think through, I don't find the I in form in my body. I don't find it in my feelings of positive.
So it's not here. It's not here.
It's not in any of those things, but it still feels like it's somewhere.
It's somewhere. It's somewhere.
Is that the same part that goes through Bardo, the part of the mind, the imprint of the mind that travels through Bardo?
The part of the mind that goes through the Bardo. Well.
Is that the same?
It's like even though we talk about rebirth and reincarnation, there's no one solid thing that's going somewhere from that's independent and self-existent. No. It seems like the mind then is something, right? But when you think of the mind, where is the solid self-existent mind?
Right.
Yeah. Because when I talked about how, is the mind your happy mind, your sad mind, your depressed mind, your grieving mind, your grasping attachment mind, right? That's clinging to my body, my things, It's like we grasp at this body when we know its condition, It's like mine's falling apart and I still grasp at it. Right? It's like we need to check and analyze a little bit. I'll just do a very quick aside as I went to hear Bishop Spong, who's this incredible Christian teacher, and he was saying, people talk about Jesus ascending into the heavens, and then they talk about the heavens being someplace just beyond the sky. And he says, according to physics and astronomy and all of these things, he says, we would know that if Jesus in fact ascended into the sky, he would have gone into orbit, right? And so we need to check and analyze a little more carefully about our views. And this is why His Holiness likes to really check up a little more carefully with the sciences too. One of the scientists said to His Holiness, well, what if we disprove karma? What if we disprove it? And His Holiness said, well, we'd throw it out. But prove it to me. Prove it to me. And so, it's like having that sense of real analysis and checking and this open-mindedness to really check up, Another thing Bishop Spong says, it's like Mary gave birth to Jesus, and he was the Christ child. And he says, according to genetics today, we know that a woman contributes an egg to the birth of a child. And so really thinking about that, he says, according to genetics from the first century, it was like the womb of the woman was just like a place to grow the child, that the woman had nothing else to do with it. But he says a woman today offers, that has the ovum, right? And so there's the, so he's saying, so was Jesus half Christ and half human? No? He says, it's important to really, really check up and see and analyze our understanding of things. So, okay, I'm getting into muddy waters here, but... So it says Buddha was asked by Vachagota, a practitioner, is there a self? Is there a self? And the Buddha was silent. He didn't say anything. And then Vachagota asked, is there no self? He has to change the tape. Mm-hmm.
Wasn't it earlier on, before the Buddha was enlightened, and the Brahmin was called, they believed in self.
Yes, that's true.
And the Buddha said no, and he, that's why he went his way.
Right. Okay, are we rolling? Okay, so again, the Buddha was silent. And they say that he did this because otherwise, if he agreed to them, he would be siding with the holders of eternalism or siding with the holders of nihilism. And so in Buddhism, we're really looking at, you know, if you negate too little, if you negate a self-existence too little, you fall into permanence, that there is something solid, independent, and self-existent. Yeah? And so if you you conceive something to exist that doesn't exist, you lead towards self and permanence. And this is also where, you know, a view of a creator God as a source comes in. There's something, there's got to be something substantial that's creating all of this. Okay, if you negate too much, then you deny existence. Because we're here. No, we're experiencing pain and suffering and joy and happiness and family and friends and Dharma friends and path. We're experiencing all of these things. But it says if you negate too much, you fall into nihilism and annihilation. And this is where radical materialists fall into nihilistic views, you know. Some of you might have seen that program that Barbara Walters did on Where is Heaven? You see that, and the materialists were saying that's it. You know, after this life, kaput. There's nothing. There's nothing. That who we are is just this kind of chemical reaction that's going on all the time. Right, and then at death, there's nothing. So we need to really check up and analyze what is it that we hold and believe. Where is it? How do we hold our existence or non-existence or middle way? You know? So really to check and analyze and look at this. So the Buddhists establish what they call a middle way between the extremes. They say there's a conventional self, that we're operating according to karma and conditions, that we have the potential to create virtue, to purify negativities and to attain enlightenment. We have this. Yeah, but in fact, within that, there is no permanent, independent self-existence. So I'll go into this a little bit further. Nagarjuna in Fundamentals of the Middle Way says, if the self were the aggregates, these are called the aggregates, form, feeling, perception, mental formations, and consciousness, if the self were these things, it would have to have arising and ceasing, if that were self. As a property of self, it would arise and disappear, isn't it? And if they were different from these things, if they were different from the aggregates, form, feeling, perception, mental formations, and consciousness, then it would not have any of these characteristics. It wouldn't have any of these. But yet still, within this, we call call ourselves. So it's more about this conventional I, they often say the merely labeled I. Now, this is hard stuff. I mean, we're grappling with trying to find something that's quite elusive, that we're run by all the time. Okay? So it says if there's no inherent self-existent self, then it must be identical to or different from the aggregates. If the self is identical to these things, it would be constantly changing, constantly arising, since that's what the aggregates do. If they're distinct from them, then our relationship becomes kind of nebulous, isn't it? If our self is not these, but there's still a separate self, then it becomes quite mysterious as to where that is. Okay? So this also applies to all phenomena, to your house, to your car, to your friends, to your parents, to your things. Okay? When your car is sitting outside, it seems to be that there's definitely a car there that brought you here and that's going to take you home. Yeah? But when you look at the aggregates of the car, where is the car, the self-existent car? Is it in the tires? Is it in the steering wheel? Is it in the engine? Because when you take apart the car, where is the car? If you had all the pieces of the car in this room laid out, where is the car?
It's when you put it together. When you put all the pieces together, then you have the car.
When you put it all together, you have a car. When you put all these aggregates together, you have a self. Yeah? So it's a merely labeled car, but it's made up of tires, steering wheel, windows, engine, frame, yeah? Just like that. I am made up of my body and my mind and my consciousness and my, you know, my perceptions. But where is that independent one? It's saying that doesn't exist, yeah? But there's definitely something that's there. Conventionally, there's something there that's carrying on, that's operating with these aggregates. Okay, so Nagarjuna continues, neither the aggregates nor different from the aggregates. The aggregates are not in you, nor are you in the aggregates. And you're not the possessor of the aggregates. So what are you?
Intelligent space.
Intelligent space. And sometimes unintelligent space. Right? Uh-huh, Tina. Is it a result that changes according to the relationship with the five aggregates? How they react with things that are conventional? Okay. You know, this is a really challenging to look at, because we keep wanting to look for something self-existent. We keep wanting to find something that's really there. So it's looking at this very interesting relationship, isn't it? So I'll go over what's called a fivefold analysis. And okay, so it says the self can't be the aggregates for two reasons. The self cannot be the aggregates for two reasons. Okay? If the self is posited to be unitary, the aggregates are plural. Then you would have many selves. aggregates are constantly undergoing change, while the self that we posit is meant to endure as a single entity. It seems like there's something there that even when we die, right, it's going to the next life, and then through the bardo that there's something there. But it's saying it's constantly undergoing change. The aggregates are undergoing change, while this self is, we're positing, is supposed to be this enduring thing. Okay? So the self cannot be different from the aggregates. So we're looking for ourself, aren't we? So the self cannot be different from the aggregates, because anything that happens to the aggregates happens to the self as well. Yeah? When I fall down and hurt myself, I'm hurting my aggregates. I'm hurting my aggregates, I'm hurting myself. Yeah? And so it says, in this case, we're talking about how Buddhahood or enlightenment is presumably attained by purifying the aggregates through practice. And if the aggregates were entirely different from the self, then it's not clear how purifying the aggregates would lead you to enlightenment. Okay? So the self now cannot stand outside the aggregates as a basis, you know, like somehow they're all stacked up and self is under here somewhere. Because if you take away the aggregates, then there's nothing there. There's no basis or support there. Okay? And for the same reason, there's no core in there. There's some core. There's something in there. We're looking at where is this? I'll just get through this part first. So the fifth possibility is that the self is some distance away from, but dependent on the aggregates. Yeah? It's kind of hanging out somewhere, but it's a little distant away from the aggregates. So from the standpoint of positing an inherently existent Buddha, then you can't say Buddha is dependent on aggregates. Yeah? If the Buddha were dependent on the aggregates, he would lack essence. He would lack essence and would be empty. So it says you can't say that we have an essence through a relationship to another, since that means essential difference, which implies the Buddha and aggregates have individual essences. All of this is just, you know, analysis to begin to look at where is this strong grasping to self that we have, and to begin to erode that away. Okay? All right, so we're going to do another short exercise to analyze this. To just get comfortable in your body, in your aggregates. So if there's an independent self-existence, it would have to be one and the same with your mental and physical aggregates, or completely separate from them, if there is an independent self. So examine your body and your mind. Is the I one of these? Try to find a self that's independent of your body and mind. Can the I be in one place and your body and mind in another? So determine that the self is not separate from the body and mind. And now call a time when you experience strong emotion. How does the I appear then? So the self does not exist the way we previously felt. Okay, you can come out of your meditation. Any comment? Yeah.
I was just wondering if the idea of no self or self is tied to emptiness? Yes. And the whole idea of...
Is the self tied to emptiness?
Yeah, the no self.
Yes, definitely. Yes. Yeah. Okay, so this is part of the analysis that we're going through, looking at the emptiness of self and phenomena. Okay. So we'll continue a little bit more. So desire, hatred, and confusion all arise from thought. It is said, this is Nagarjuna, they all depend on the pleasant, the unpleasant, and errors. Form, sound, taste, touch, smell, and concepts of things, these six are thought of as the foundation of desire, hatred, and confusion. Okay. So how are we creating the conditions for samsaric existence? It's saying, right, desire, hatred, and confusion, our reactive emotions, are arising from a thought. And they depend on the pleasant, the unpleasant, and errors. Yeah, sensory stimulus arise, you experience pleasant, unpleasant, neutral. You interpret it, go into a reactive emotion, engage in negative actions, create the karma for future conditions. Form, sound, taste, touch, smell, and the concepts of things. These six should be seen as only like a city of the Gandharvas and like a mirage or a dream. Okay, city of Gandharvas is like this kind of pleasure ground. And says, you know, all of these things that we experience should be seen like a mirage or a dream. And when we see things as a mirage or a dream, then we stop grasping at them. You watch the illusion of it arising. You watch the pleasure and displeasure and all of these emotions arise. You see phenomena arise, but you don't grasp and cling to them. Okay, so in the same way, it says you should view the defilements as you view yourself. They are not defiled in the fivefold way. View the defiled as you would view yourself. It is not the defilements in the fivefold way. Okay, basically what he's saying, yourself is not identical to the aggregates. It's not completely different from the aggregates, present as a basis of the aggregates, contained within the aggregates as a core, or dependent, separate or dependent upon the aggregates. So it's kind of tough stuff, but important to analyze and look at. Okay, so I just want to read something from His Holiness about this. His Holiness says in the Four Noble Truths, the reason why it is so important to understanding this subtle point is because of its implications for interpreting your own personal experience of life. When strong emotions arise in you, attachment or anger, If you examine the experience of that emotion, you will see that underlying it is an assumption that there is something subjective and real out there which you are holding onto, and onto which you project desirable or undesirable qualities. According to the kind of qualities you project onto a thing or event, you feel either attracted or repulsed by it. So strong emotional responses, in fact, assume the existence of some form of objective reality. So all of those strong emotions then are being driven by this sense of something, some self-existence in self and others. And it's saying when we can begin to tease that out and work through that, then we can begin to diminish the heat of our attachment, our craving, our grasping, and then ensue, you know, our negative actions that follow along from that. Okay? Any questions? You're hanging in there with me.
Is the self like the house and the aggregates are what's inside the house?
So then that would be the house is possessing the aggregates?
Yeah, I suppose.
Yeah. It's saying that it's none of these, because we keep looking for something, some kind of possessor or some kind of owner or some kind of intrinsic existence. And what we need to do is continually wear away that strong grasping at that particular view. Because like Nagarjuna was saying, you know, it seems like there's something inside as a core, there's something outside, there's something that's a possessor, a basis, but it's not any of those. Uh-huh.
Then who water inherits the karma?
Yeah, what's experiencing the karma? Huh? So on a conventional level, this is why when we're looking at the path and what we're trying to attain, we need to use right understanding and right view to comprehend that on a conventional level, things, karma and kleshas have an effect. It's in full operation. Causes create effects. So on a conventional level, there, you know, your conventional self is experiencing the effect of conditions that we created in the past, causes that we're creating now in our present. Okay, Tina. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Using right speech and how do you relate with others in calling? Well, we are, again, on a conventional level, things are in full operation, you know? Even though I can't find an inherent existent Tenzin in here, you know, I am still creating conditions, karmic conditions and causes in my living and experience. In my naming others, you know, it's like there are conventional truths, you know. To call Sharon, Sharon is appropriate, you know. To call you, Sharon, is not appropriate because that is not your name, you know. So if things operate and function appropriately in the conventional sense. Yeah.
You know, I read someplace when you reach the path of seeing, you don't make any new karma that you're going to be enslaved by. So what does the path of seeing actually mean?
So he's saying when you reach this particular level in your practice called the path of seeing, you create no more negative karma. So what does reaching this mean? The path of seeing means that you are seeing emptiness directly. You are seeing the nature of phenomena and things directly. You no longer have this view of seeing things as inherently existent. So we can do this intellectually, philosophically. You know, we can understand that things are interdependent. But until we see it directly through our experience, then we have this subtle grasping itself and grasping at phenomena, and we act upon it. So they say, when you see things directly, then you act appropriately, and you no longer create negative karma. Yeah. Uh-huh, Mimi?
Well, Geshe-la gave an example of being this magician. And just in that they can make people see horses and elephants on the stage. And the people who are in the audience say, yes. Right. It's there. Everybody really believes in it. But the magician sees the same thing. But he knows it's not true. It's not real. It's dependent on how he did this. And Buddha and Bodhisattva, very high up, will say, we know it's not there. So it's how we ourselves view things. It's dependent on how we think about things. You know, but we think that, well, I want is like, for instance, a car. But before you got the car, it wasn't yours. But now we say it is mine. My car. If someone heard it, they get very angry. But it's not like that. It's the way we put things onto it, dependently. It's not inherently self-existing car of ours. It's the way we say it. That's our. That's my husband. That's my wife. That's my child. That's my. This is my temple. If something happens to it, we'll be just crushed. But it's when we look at it, we can change it. We can determine to think about it and let it go, not grasp onto it. And I mean, I've been trying to show this to us.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, thank you. So Mamie gave the example about the magician and seeing things in different ways. So the magician sees one view, the audience sees another, and someone walking in separately would see it in a third way. So so in the path, then, you know, there is what's called the Eightfold Path that helps us to conduct ourselves in a way so that we can begin to diminish the heat of the delusive views that we have and emotions that we have, so that we can gain greater and greater comprehension of the nature of phenomena, that we can attain the path of seeing and the other paths as well. So they're called are the right view, and this is understanding on a conventional level that karma and its fruits operate, are in full operation, and that we are responsible for acts. And then on the ultimate level, that we have the potential to attain enlightenment and liberation. So looking at right intention or purpose is, in the Theravada view, it's renunciation to be free from selfish desire and grasping, developing benevolence, and then harmlessness, that wishing others be free from pain and suffering, and for ourselves to live in a way that we don't inflict harm on others. But in the Mahayana view, then it's the intention and purpose to attain enlightenment for the benefit of all beings. So right speech, then, you know, we talk about right action of body, speech, and mind. Speech here could be, you know, the four virtuous actions: not to lie, not to slander, not to gossip, and not to divide others. But it can also be looking at how we can change our attention in this. All of these, the Eightfold Path, and working with the 12 links, is looking at how we operate in our lives so that we bring greater attention and awareness into all of our actions, so that we say and do things with attention and care. You know, it's like, rather than just a classic scene would be a couple that's been together forever, right? And you just say, yes, dear, no, dear, yes, dear, no, dear. And there's very little attention and care in it, and it's just like a pat, flat answer. So, you know, really looking at how can we bring more energy and interest into all of our actions of body, speech, and mind, so that we are speaking with a little more energy and interest and care. So regardless if it's our family members or people that we work with and deal with all the time, our friends, you know, watch when our attention is just kind of falling off into disrespect and uncare, no? And try to raise your attention in looking at these qualities and, you know, actions of body, speech, and mind, so that we operate with more loving kindness in our interactions. So that's right speech. Right action would be not to kill, steal, or engage in sexual misconduct. Right livelihood, they say, classically, it's earning one's living by honest means. And the Buddha mentions five trades not to engage in, which are not to engage in weapons and beings, that is, in a slave trade, meat, intoxicants, and poisons. So that we should not engage in these trades. Right concentration, then, is to see things clearly and not to be compulsively governed by our negative and impulsive urges, or just to be idle. Okay. So right effort, then, is a sustained endeavor to remove unwholesome states which hinder our concentration and to develop positive qualities in all of our actions. And the last one is right mindfulness, is to clear awareness and attention of objects so that we have greater comprehension of objects of contemplation. So then there are many, many different meditations related to all of these. Meditation on four foundations of mindfulness, which are mindfulness of the body, feelings, states of mind, mental objects. There are meditations on all of these. So, you know, in our practice, there's so much to work on. And in conclusion, since we're done, I would just like to say, you know, it's like the Buddha did not teach this because it was just going to give us a hard time, or it's just a mental exercise. But it was really, you know, really saying that we have the potential to do this. We can attain, we can totally purify our kleshas, our delusions, and negative karma, and attain liberation and enlightenment. We have that potential. And there's also what's called Buddha nature, no, which is this enlightened potential within us all. So to really have this kind of buoyancy and the possibility that we can attain this. Now, again, there's the path to liberation and enlightenment that we cannot, we have it inside us. It's not outside of ourselves. You know, by really exerting ourselves through conscientiousness and endeavor, we can attain this. So, you know, I think, again, we really need to observe. In general, we're good persons. but to look and see where it is that we're falling off. We're falling off the boat in our actions. No, because I was chatting with one day at lunch, Annie and I were chatting at lunch with some of the Tibetans, you know, and they're talking about some of the job situations that they experience. And I haven't been in that kind of job for a long time, you know, like waitressing or being in a bus boy kind of situation. But there's some people can be so cruel to others in a work situation. There's thievery. That, like, what was it? The owner of the restaurant was stealing the tips out of the tip jar from her waitresses, you know, and the things that we do to others, you know, and we think that we're being smart or clever or we're benefiting ourselves, but we're creating the karma, you know. It's like to you wonder why we get ripped off, or you wonder why we don't trust others. And, you know, it's like we have this kind of world and society where we're just continually hurting others, you know. So to see, you know, not only with your spiritual practice and being really good on your meditation seat, you know, but really taking it into your family, you know, watching the attention and awareness as you work with others, but also into the workspace, in public, in your taxes, now that tax season is here, you know, and all of these things, okay? So to observe that. So we'll finish with our dedication prayers. Yeah, okay. So before we close, we should also add Melinda Lee to our prayers. Melinda is one of the oldest students of Geshe-la's, right? She started when she was a teenager, huh? Yeah, 17, yeah. So Melinda suffered a stroke recently, and she's still so young, you know, to have to endure such suffering. So let's add Melinda to our prayers. Also, Jim Shea is a friend of a student.
A brother.
Pam Adams, who's going through the last stages of cancer. And my friend Maureen White, when I was going to Naropa, finishing my master's, she housed me over the years. And she has throat cancer and is in the hospital with pneumonia right now. As well as, you know, losing her hair and the radiation and chemotherapy. So going through incredible struggle right now. So let's say prayers for these friends and just like that for all beings. We'll say the Shenrezi mantra. Om Mani Padme Hum, Om Mani Padme Hum, Om Mani Padme Hum, Om Mani Padme Hum. Om Mani Padme Hum, 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 Om Mani Padme Hum. And we'll complete with the dedication of merits. Because of these merits, may we quickly become Guru Lord Buddha and lead each and every sentient being into his enlightened realm. May the precious bodhicitta that has not yet been received be received, and may that which has not been received be increased and not decreased. May the precious view of emptiness, shunyata, that has not been received be received, and may that which has been received be increased and not decreased.
by the virtue of offering to you assembly of Buddhas, assembly, visualize before me, this mandala built on a base resplendent with flowers, saffron, water, and incense, adorned with Mount Meru and the four continents, as well as with the sun and the moon, may all sentient beings share its effects. Idam Guru Ratna Mandala Kanya Tayami. In the land of snowy mountains, you are the source of all happiness and good. Lord Shinrezi Tenzin Gyatso, may you stay until samsara ends. So there's no class next Sunday, which is Easter Sunday. And we have a couple more announcements after we do our vows. Thank you.
First of all, this afternoon at 5 o'clock, we're doing a special Soga offering for Lee Pham's father and Connie. Not sure why that happened, but anyway, at 5 p.m., everyone is invited. You can bring a small fruit offering or anything like that, but please join us. If you can, it's his 49th day since his passing. So it's very special. So please join us. Everyone's invited. Also, next Saturday, April 7th, Geshe Gelson arrives back with the other students at LAX, Tom Bradley. It's flight 456 on Lufthansa, and it arrives at 12:35. If you want to go to the airport and greet Geshe-la or greet Geshe-la here when he arrives back, please join us either at the airport. Takes a while. It'll be the Tom Bradley where people come out going through customs. So either there or here. It will be quick here because he'll just come right in and go upstairs, but at the airport it's always exciting. So that's that. You have more?
Yeah. I have a couple other announcements. Thank you. The first one is if you haven't signed this book for Melinda, it's a Get Well book, please do so. Please take an entire page. I want to just send her lots and lots of love. So who hasn't and would like to? Thank you. The other thing is that Tashi, Geshe-la's niece, has recently heard from Tibet that one of their childhood friends has recently was killed in a terrible accident. He'd been working in building Chamdo Gompo.